reality. Her lips twitched in a kind of elementary surprise, and she halted, as if groping for old bearings in a new world. "The closet," she muttered. "Go to your closet and pray." "No." Mama raised her hand to strike. "No." The hand stopped in the dead air. Mama stared up at it, as if to confirm that it was still there and whole. The pie pan suddenly rose from the trivet on the table and hurled itself across the room to impact beside the living room door in a splash of blueberry drool. "I'm going, Mama." Mama's overturned teacup rose and flew past her head to shatter above the stove. Mama shrieked and dropped to her knees with her hands over her head. "Devil's child," she moaned. "Devil's child. Satan's spawn. Mama, stand up. Lust and licentiousness, the cravings of the flesh. Stand up." Mama's voice failed her, but she did stand up, with her hands still on her head like a prisoner of war. Her lips moved. To Carrie, she seemed to be reciting the Lord's Prayer. "I don't want to fight with you, Mama," Carrie said, and her voice almost broke from her and dissolved. She struggled to control it. "I only want to be let to live my own life. I don't like yours." She stopped, horrified in spite of herself. The ultimate blasphemy had been spoken, and it was 1,000 times worse than the F word. "Witch," Mama whispered. "It says in the Lord's book, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Your father did the Lord's work." "I don't want to talk about that," Carrie said. It always disturbed her to hear Mama talk about her father. "I just want you to understand that things are going to change around here, Mama." Her eyes gleamed. "They better understand it, too." But Mama was whispering to herself again. Unsatisfied, with a feeling of anticlimax in her throat and the dismal roiling of emotional upset in her belly, she went to the cellar to get her dress material. It was better than the closet. There was that. Anything was better than the closet with its blue light and the overpowering stench of sweat and her own sin. Anything. Everything. She stood with the wrapped package hugged against her breast and closed her eyes, shutting out the weak glow of the cellar's bare, cobweb-festooned bulb. Tommy Ross didn't love her. She knew that. This was some strange kind of atonement, and she could understand that and respond to it. She had lain cheek and jowl with the concept of penance since she had been old enough to reason. He said it would be good, that they would see to it. Well, she would see to it. They better not start anything. They just better not. She did not know if her gift had come from the Lord of Light or of darkness, and now, finally finding that she did not care which, she was overcome with an almost indescribable relief, as if a huge weight, long carried, had slipped from her shoulders. Upstairs, Mama continued to whisper. It was not the Lord's Prayer. It was the prayer of exorcism from Deuteronomy. From My Name is Susan Snell, page 23. They finally even made a movie about it. I saw it last April. When I came out, I was sick. Whenever anything important happens in America, they have to gold-plate it like baby shoes. That way you can forget it, and forgetting Carrie White may be a bigger mistake than anyone realizes. Monday morning, Principal Grail and his understudy, Pete Morton, were having coffee in Grail's office. "No word from Hargensen yet?" Morty asked. His lips curled into a John Wayne leer that was a little frightened around the edges. "Not a peep. And Christine has stopped lipping off about how her father is going to send us down the road." Grail blew on his coffee with a long face. "You don't exactly seem to be turning cartwheels." "I'm not. Did you know Carrie White is going to the prom?" Morty blinked. "With who? The Beak?" The Beak was Freddie Holt. another of Ewan's misfits. He weighed perhaps 100 pounds soaking wet, and the casual observer might be tempted to believe that 60 of it was nose. "No," Grail said, "with Tommy Ross." Morty swallowed his coffee the wrong way and went into a coughing fit. "That's the way I felt," Grail said. "What about his girlfriend, the little Snell girl?" "I think she put him up to it," Grail said. "She certainly seemed guilty enough about what happened to Carrie when I talked to her. Now she's on the decoration committee, happy as a clam, just as if not going to her senior prom was nothing at all."
"Oh," Morty said wisely.
"And Hargensen? I think he must have talked to some people and discovered we really could sue him on behalf of Carrie White if we wanted to. I think he's cut his losses. It's the daughter that's worrying me."
"Do you think there's going to be an incident Friday night?"
"I don't know. I do know Chris has got a lot of friends who are going to be there, and she's going around with that Billy Nolan mess. He's got a zoo full of friends, too. The kind that make a career out of scaring pregnant ladies. Chris Hargensen has him tied around her finger, from what I've heard. Are you afraid of anything specific?"
Grail made a restless gesture.
"Specific? No. But I've been in the game long enough to know it's a bad situation. Do you remember the Stadler game in 76?
Morty nodded. It would take more than the passage of 3 years to obscure the memory of the Ewan Stadler game. Bruce Trevor had been a marginal student, but a fantastic basketball player. Coach Gaines didn't like him, but Trevor was going to put Ewan in the area tournament for the first time in 10 years. He was cut from the team a week before Ewan's last must-win game against the Stadler Bobcats. A regular announced locker inspection had uncovered a kilo of marijuana behind Trevor's civics book. Ewan lost the game and their shot at the tourney, 104-48, but no one remembered that. What they remembered was the riot that had interrupted the game in the fourth period. Led by Bruce Trevor, who righteously claimed he had been bum-wrapped, it resulted in 4 hospital admissions. One of them had been the Stadler coach, who had been hit over the head with a first aid kit.
"I've got that kind of feeling," Grail said. "A hunch. Someone's going to come with rotten apples or something."
"Maybe you're psychic," Morty said. From The Shadow Exploded, pages 92 to 93. It is now generally agreed that the TK phenomenon is a genetic recessive occurrence, but the opposite of a disease like hemophilia, which becomes overt only in males. In that disease, once called King's Evil, the gene is recessive in the female and is carried harmlessly. Male offspring, however, are bleeders. This disease is generated only if an afflicted male marries a woman carrying the recessive gene. If the offspring of such union is male, the result will be a hemophiliac son. If the offspring is female, the result will be a daughter who is a carrier. It should be emphasized that the hemophilia gene may be carried recessively in the male as a part of his genetic makeup. But if he marries a woman with the same outlaw gene, the result will be hemophilia if the offspring is male. In the case of royal families, where intermarriage was common, the chance of the gene reproducing once it entered the family tree was high, thus the name King's Evil. Hemophilia also showed up in significant quantities in Appalachia during the earlier part of the century, and is commonly noticed in those cultures where incest and the marriage of first cousins is common. With the TK phenomenon, the male appears to be the carrier. The TK gene may be recessive in the female, but dominates only in the female. It appears that Ralph White carried the gene. Margaret Brigham, by purest chance, also carried the outlaw gene sign, but we may be fairly confident that it was recessive, as no information has ever been found to indicate that she had telekinetic powers resembling her daughter's. Investigations are now being conducted into the life of Margaret Brigham's grandmother, Sadie Cochran. For if the dominant recessive pattern obtains with TK as it does with hemophilia, Mrs. Cochran may have been TK dominant. If the issue of the white marriage had been male, the result would have been another carrier. Chances that the mutation would have died with him would have been excellent, as neither side of the Ralph White-Margaret Brigham alliance had cousins of a comparable age for the theoretical male offspring to marry, and the chances of meeting and marrying another woman with a TK gene at random would be small. None of the teams working on the problem have yet isolated the gene. Surely no one can doubt, in light of the Maine Holocaust, that isolating this gene must become one of medicine's number one priorities. The hemophiliac, or H gene, produces male issue with a lack of blood platelets. The telekinetic, or TK gene, produces female typhoid Marys, capable of destroying almost at will. Wednesday afternoon. Susan and 14 other students, the Spring Ball Decoration Committee no less, were working on the huge mural that would hang behind the twin bandstands on Friday night. The theme was springtime in Venice. Who picked these hokey themes, Sue wondered. She had been a student at UN for 4 years, had attended 2 balls, and she still didn't know. Why did the goddamn thing need a theme anyway? Why not just have a sock hop and be done with it? George Chismar, Ewan's most artistic student, had done a small chalk sketch of gondolas on a canal at sunset, and a gondolier in a huge straw fedora leaning against the tiller as a gorgeous panoply of pinks and reds and oranges stained both sky and water. It was beautiful, no doubt about that. He had redrawn it in silhouette on a huge 14-by-20-foot canvas flat, numbering the various sections to go with various chalk hues. Now the committee was patiently coloring it in, like children crawling over a huge page in a giant's coloring book. Still, Sue thought, looking at her hands and forearms, both heavily dusted with pink chalk, it was going to be the prettiest prom ever. Next to her, Helen Shire sat up on her haunches, stretched, and groaned as her back popped. She brushed a hank of hair from her forehead with the back of her hand, leaving a rose-colored smear. "How in hell did you talk me into this? You want it to be nice, don't you?" Sue mimicked Miss Greer, the spinster chairman, apt enough term for Miss Mustache, of the decoration committee. "Yeah, but why not the refreshment committee or the entertainment committee? Less back, more mind. The mind, that's my area. Besides, you're not even..." She bit down on the words. "Going?" Susan shrugged and picked up her chalk again. She had a monstrous writer's cramp. "No, but I still want it to be nice." She added shyly, "Tommy's going." They worked in silence for a bit, and then Helen stopped again. No one was near them. The closest was Holly Marshall, on the other end of the mural, coloring the gondola's keel. "Can I ask you about it, Sue?" Helen asked finally. "God, everybody's talking." "Sure." Sue stopped coloring and flexed her hand. "Maybe I ought to tell someone just so the story stays straight. I asked Tommy to take Carrie. I'm hoping it'll bring her out of herself a little, knock down some of the barriers. I think I owe her that much." "Where does that put the rest of us?" Helen asked without rancor. Sue shrugged. "You have to make up your own mind about what we did, Helen. I'm in no position to throw stones, but I don't want people to think I'm, playing martyr. Something like that." "And Tommy went along with it?" This was the part that most fascinated her. "Yes," Sue said, and did not elaborate. After a pause, "I suppose the other kids think I'm stuck up." Helen thought it over. "Well, they're all talking about it. But most of them still think you're okay. Like you said, you make your own decisions. There is, however, a small dissenting faction." She snickered dolefully. "The Chris Hargensen people?" "And the Billy Nolan people. God, he's scuzzy." "She doesn't like me much?" Sue said, making it a question.
Susie, she hates your guts.
Susan nodded, surprised to find the thought both distressed and excited her. I heard her father was going to sue the school department, and then he changed his mind, she said. Helen shrugged. She hasn't made any friends out of this, she said. I don't know what got into us, any of us. It makes me feel like I don't even know my own mind. They worked on in silence. Across the room, Don Barrett was putting up an extension ladder preparatory to gliding the overhead steel beams with crepe paper. Look, Helen said, there goes Chris now. Susan looked up just in time to see her walking into the cubbyhole office to the left of the gym entrance. She was wearing wine-colored velvet hot pants and a silky white blouse. No bra, from the way things were jiggling up front. A dirty old man's dream, Sue thought sourly, and then wondered what Chris could want in where the prom committee had set up shop. Of course, Tina Blake was on the committee, and the two of them were thicker than thieves. Stop it, she scolded herself. Do you want her in sackcloth and ashes? Yes, she admitted. A part of her wanted just that. Helen? Are they going to do something? Helen's face took on an unwilling mask-like quality. I don't know. The voice was light, over-innocent.
Oh, Sue said noncommittally. You know something. Accept something, goddammit, if it's only yourself, tell me.
They continued to color, and neither spoke. She knew it wasn't as all right as Helen had said. It couldn't be. She would never be quite the same golden girl in the eyes of her mates. She had done an ungovernable, dangerous thing. She had broken cover and shown her face. The late afternoon sunlight, warm as oil and sweet as childhood, slanted through the high, bright gymnasium windows. From My Name is Susan Snell, page 40. I can understand some of what must have led up to the prom. Awful as it was, I can understand how someone like Billy Nolan could go along, for instance. Chris Hargensen led him by the nose, at least most of the time. His friends were just as easily led by Billy himself. Kenny Garson, who dropped out of high school when he was 18, had a tested third-grade reading level. In the clinical sense, Steve Dayan was little more than an idiot. Some of the others had police records. One of them, Jackie Talbot, was first busted at the age of 9 for stealing hubcaps. If you've got a social worker mentality, you can even regard these people as unfortunate victims. But what can you say for Chris Hargensen herself? It seems to me that from first to last, her one and only object in view was the complete and total destruction of Carrie White.
I'm not supposed to, Tina Blake said uneasily. She was a small, pretty girl with a billow of red hair. A pencil was pushed importantly in it. And if Norma comes back, she'll spill. She's in the crapper, Chris said. Come on.
Tina, a little shocked, giggled in spite of herself. Still, she offered token resistance. Why do you want to see, anyway? You can't go.
Never mind, Chris said. As always, she seemed to bubble with dark humor.
Here, Tina said, and pushed a sheet enclosed in limp plastic across the desk. I'm going out for a Coke. If that bitchy Norma Watson comes back and catches you, I never saw you.
Okay, Chris murmured, already absorbed in the floor plan. She didn't hear the door close. George Chismar had also done the floor plan, so it was perfect. The dance floor was clearly marked, twin bandstands, the stage where the king and queen would be crowned.
I'd like to crown that fucking Snell bitch, Carrie too,
at the end of the evening. Ranged along the three sides of the floor were the promgoers' tables, card tables, actually, but covered with a froth of crepe and ribbon, each holding party favors, prom programs, and ballots for king and queen. She ran a lacquered, spade-shaped fingernail down the tables to the right of the dance floor, then the left,
there. Tommy R. and Carrie W. They were really going through with it. She could hardly believe it. Outrage made her tremble. Did they really think they would be allowed to get away with it? Her lips tautened grimly. She looked over her shoulder. Norma Watson was still nowhere in sight. Chris put the seating chart back and riffled quickly through the rest of the papers on the pitted and initial-scarred desk. Invoices, mostly for crepe paper and halfpenny nails, a list of parents who had loaned card tables, petty cash vouchers, a bill from Star Printers who had run off the prom tickets, a sample king and queen ballot. Ballot? She snatched it up. No one was supposed to see the actual king and queen ballot until Friday when the whole student body would hear the candidates announce over the school's intercom. The king and queen would be voted in by those attending the prom, but blank nomination ballots had been circulated to homerooms almost a month earlier. The results were supposed to be top secret. There was a gaining student move afoot to do away with the king and queen business altogether. Some of the girls claimed it was sexist. The boys thought it was just plain stupid and a little embarrassing. Chances were good that this would be the last year the dance would be so formal or traditional. But for Chris, this was the only year that counted. She stared at the ballot with greedy intensity. George and Frida. No way! Frida Jason was a Jew. Peter and Myra. No way! Here either. Myra was one of the female clique dedicated to erasing the whole horse race. She wouldn't serve even if elected. Besides, she was about as good-looking as the ass-end of old dray horse Ethel. Frank and Jessica. Quite possible. Frank Greer had made the all-New England football team this year, but Jessica was another little sparrow fart with more pimples than brains. Don and Helen. Forget it. Helen Shires couldn't get elected dog catcher. And the last pairing. Tommy and Sue. Only Sue, of course, had been crossed out, and Carrie's name had been written in. There was a pairing to conjure with. A kind of strange, shuffling laughter came over her, and she clapped a hand over her mouth to hold it in. Tina scurried back in. Jesus, Chris, you still here? She's coming. Don't sweat it, doll, Chris said, and put the papers back on the desk. She was still grinning as she walked out, pausing to raise a mocking hand to Sue Snell, who was slaving her skinny butt off on that stupid mural. In the outer hall, she fumbled a dime from her bag, dropped it into the payphone, and called Billy Nolan. From The Shadow Exploded, pages 100 to 101. One wonders just how much planning went into the ruination of Carrie White. Was it a carefully made plan, rehearsed and gone over many times, or just something that happened in a bumbling sort of way? I favor the latter idea. I suspect that Christine Hargensen was the brains of the affair, but that she herself had only the most nebulous of ideas on how one might get a girl like Carrie. I rather suspect it was she who suggested that William Nolan and his friends make the trip to Irwin Henty's farm in North Chamberlain. The thought of that trip's imagined result would have appealed to a warped sense of poetic justice, I am sure. The car screamed up the rutted Stack End Road in North Chamberlain at a 65 that was dangerous to life and limb on the washboard, unpaved hardpan. A low-hanging branch, lush with May leaves, occasionally scraped the roof of the 61 Biscayne, which was fender-dented, rusted out, jacked in the back, and equipped with dual glass-pack mufflers. One headlight was out. The other flickered in the midnight dark when the car struck a particularly rough bump. Billy Nolan was at the pink fuzz-covered wheel. Jackie Talbot, Henry Blake, Steve Dayan, and the Garson brothers, Kenny and Lou, were also squeezed in. Three joints were going, passing through the inner dark like the lambent eyes of some rotating Cerberus. "You sure Henny ain't around?" Henry asked. "I got no urge to go back up, old sweet William. They feed you shit." Kenny Garson, who was wrecked to the fifth power, found this unutterably funny and emitted a slipstream of high-pitched giggles. "He ain't around," Billy said. Even those few words seemed to slip out grudgingly against his will. Funeral. Chris had found this out accidentally. Old Man Henty ran one of the few successful independent farms in the Chamberlain area. Unlike the crotchety old farmer with a heart of gold that is one of the staples of pastoral literature, Old Man Henty was as mean as cat dirt. He did not load his shotgun with rock salt at green apple time, but with birdshot. He had also prosecuted several fellas for pilferage. One of them had been a friend of these boys, a luckless bastard named Freddie Overlock. Freddie had been caught red-handed in Old Man Henny's henhouse and had received a double dose of No. 6 bird where the good Lord had split him. Good old Fred had spent 4 raving, cursing hours on his belly in an emergency wing examining room while a jovial intern picked tiny pellets out of his butt and dropped them into a steel pan. To add insult to injury, he had been fined $200 for larceny and trespass. There was no love lost between Irwin Henty and the Chamberlain Greaser Squad. "What about Red?" Steve asked. "He's trying to get into some new waitress at the Cavalier," Billy said, swinging the wheel and pulling the Biscayne through a juttering racing drift and onto the Henty Road. Red Trelawney was Old Man Henty's hired hand. He was a heavy drinker and just as handy with the birdshot as his employer. He won't be back until they close up.
Hell of a risk for a joke, Jackie Talbot grumbled.
Billy stiffened.
You want out?
No, Jackie said hastily. Billy had produced an ounce of good grass to split among the 5 of them, and besides, it was 9 miles back to town. It's a good joke, Billy. Kenny opened the glove compartment, took out an ornate scrolled roach clip, Chris's, and fixed the smoldering butt end of a joint in it. This operation struck him as highly amusing, and he let out his high-pitched giggle again. Now they were flashing past no trespassing signs on either side of the road, barbed wire, newly turned fields. The smell of fresh earth was heavy and gravid and sweet on the warm May air. Billy popped the headlights off as they breasted the next hill, dropped the gear shift into neutral, and killed the ignition. They rolled, a silent hulk of metal, toward the Henty driveway. Billy negotiated the turn with no trouble, and most of their speed bled away as they breasted another small rise and passed the dark and empty house. Now they could see the huge bulk of barn and beyond it, moonlight glittering dreamily on the cow pond and the apple orchard. In the pig pen, 2 sows poked their flat snouts through the bars. In the barn, 1 cow lowed softly, perhaps in sleep. Billy stopped the car with the emergency brake. Not really necessary since the ignition was off, but it was a nice commando touch. And they got out. Lou Garson reached past Kenny and got something out of the glove compartment. Billy and Henry went around to the trunk and opened it. "The bastard is going to shit where he stands when he comes back and gets a look," Steve said with soft glee.
"For Freddy," Henry said, taking the hammer out of the trunk.
Billy said nothing, but of course it was not for Freddy Overlock, who was an asshole. It was for Chris Hargensen, just as everything was for Chris, and had been since the day she swept down from her lofty college course Olympus and made herself vulnerable to him. He would have done murder for her, and more. Henry was swinging the 9-pound sledge experimentally in one hand. The heavy block of its business end made a portentous swishing noise in the night air, and the other boys gathered around as Billy opened the lid of the ice chest and took out the 2 galvanized steel pails. They were numbingly cold to the touch, lightly traced with frost. "Okay," he said. The 6 of them walked quickly to the hog pen, their respiration shortening with excitement. The 2 sows were both as tame as tabbies, and the old boar lay asleep on his side at the far end. Henry swung the sledge once more through the air, but this time with no conviction. He handed it to Billy. "I can't," he said sickly. "You."
Billy took it and looked questioningly at Lou, who held the broad butcher knife he had taken from the glove compartment. "Don't worry," he said, and touched the ball of his thumb to the honed edge. "The throat," Billy reminded. "I know." Kenny was crooning and grinning as he fed the remains of a crumpled bag of potato chips to the pigs. "Don't worry, piggies. Don't worry. Big Bill's gonna bash your fucking heads in and you won't have to worry about the bomb anymore." He scratched their bristly chins, and the pigs grunted and munched contentedly.
"Here it comes," Billy remarked, and the sledge flashed down.
There was a sound that reminded him of the time he and Henry had dropped the pumpkin off Claridge Road overpass, which crossed 495 west of town. One of the sows dropped dead with its tongue protruding, eyes still open, potato chip crumbs around its snout. Kenny giggled. "She didn't even have time to burp."
"Do it quick, Lou," Billy said. Kenny's brother slid between the slats, lifted the pig's head toward the moon. The glazing eyes regarded the crescent with rapt blankness and slashed. The flow of blood was immediate and startling. Several of the boys were splattered and jumped back with little cries of disgust. Billy leaned through and put one of the buckets under the main flow. The pail filled up rapidly, and he set it aside. The second was half full when the flow trickled and died. "The other one," he said.
"Jesus, Billy," Jackie whined. "Isn't that an... Suey! Pig, pig, pig!"
Kenny called, grinning and rattling the empty potato chip bag. After a pause, the sow returned to the fence. The sledge flashed. The second bucket was filled, and the remainder of the blood allowed to flow into the ground. A rank, coppery smell hung on the air. Billy found he was slimed in pig blood to the forearms. Carrying the pails back to the trunk, his mind made a dim, symbolic connection. Pig blood. That was good. Chris was right. It was really good. It made everything solidify. Pig blood for a pig. He nestled the galvanized steel pails into the crushed ice, capped them, and slammed the lid of the chest. "Let's go," he said. Billy got behind the wheel and released the emergency brake. The five boys got behind, put their shoulders into it, and the car turned in a tight, noiseless circle and trundled up past the barn to the crest of the hill across from Henty's house. When the car began to roll on its own, they trotted up beside the doors and climbed in, puffing and panting. The car gained speed enough to slew a little as Billy whipped it out of the long driveway and onto the Henty Road. At the bottom of the hill, he dropped the transmission into third and popped the clutch. The engine hitched and grunted into life. Pig blood for a pig. Yes, that was good, all right. That was really good. He smiled, and Lou Garson felt a start of surprise and fear. He was not sure he could recall ever having seen Billy Nolan smile before. There had not even been rumors. "Whose funeral did old man Henny go to?" Steve asked.
"His mother's," Billy said.
"His mother?" Jackie Talbot said, stunned. "Jesus Christ, she must have been older than God."
Kenny's high-pitched cackle drifted back on the redolent darkness that trembled at the edge of summer.
Part 2. Prom Night.
She put the dress on for the first time on the morning of May 27th in her room. She had bought a special brassiere to go with it, which gave her breasts the proper uplift, not that they actually needed it, but left their top halves uncovered. Wearing it gave her a weird dreamy feeling that was half shame and half defiant excitement. The dress itself was nearly floor length. The skirt was loose, but the waist was snug. The material rich and unfamiliar against her skin, which was used to only cotton and wool. The hang of it seemed to be right, or would be with the new shoes. She slipped them on, adjusted the neckline, and went to the window. She could see only a maddening ghost image of herself, but everything seemed to be right. Maybe later she could... The door swung open behind her with only a soft snick of the latch, and Carrie turned to look at her mother. She was dressed for work, wearing her white sweater and holding her black pocketbook in one hand. In the other, she was holding Daddy Ralph's Bible. They looked at each other. Hardly conscious of it, Carrie felt her back straighten until she stood straight in the patch of early spring sunshine that fell through the window.
"Red," Mama murmured. "I might have known it would be red."
Carrie said nothing.
"I can see your dirty pillows. Everyone will. They'll be looking at your body. The book says, 'Those are my breasts, Mama.' Every woman has them." "Take off that dress," Mama said.
"No. Take it off, Carrie. We'll go down and burn it in the incinerator together and then pray for forgiveness. We'll do penance."
Her eyes began to sparkle with the strange, disconnected zeal that came over her at events which she considered to be tests of faith.
"I'll stay home from work, and you'll stay home from school. We'll pray. We'll ask for a sign. We'll get us down on our knees and ask for the Pentecostal fire."
"No, Mama." Her mother reached up and pinched her own face. It left a red mark. She looked to Carrie for reaction, saw none, hooked her right hand into claws and ripped it across her own cheek, bringing thin blood. She whined and rocked back on her heels. Her eyes glowed with exultation.
"Stop hurting yourself, Mama. That's not going to make me stop either."
Mama screamed. She made her right hand a fist and struck herself in the mouth, bringing blood. She dabbled her fingers in it, looked at it dreamily, and daubed a spot on the cover of the Bible.
"Washed in the blood of the Lamb," she whispered. "Many times, many times he and I go away, Mama."
She looked up at Carrie, her eyes glowing. There was a terrifying expression of righteous anger graven on her face.
"The Lord is not mocked," she whispered. "Be sure your sin will find you out. Burn it, Carrie. Cast that devil's red from you and burn it. Burn it. Burn it. Burn it."
The door slammed open by itself.
"Go away, Mama."
Mama smiled. Her bloody mouth made the smile grotesque, twisted.
"As Jezebel fell from the tower, let it be with you," she said. "And the dogs came and licked up the blood. It's in the Bible. It's..."
Her feet began to slip along the floor, and she looked down at them, bewildered. The wood might have turned to ice.
"Stop that," she screamed.
She was in the hall now. She caught the door jamb and held on for a moment. Then her fingers were torn loose, seemingly by nothing.
"I love you, Mama," Carrie said steadily. "I'm sorry."
She envisioned the door swinging shut, and the door did just that, as if moved by a light breeze. Carefully, so as not to hurt her, she disengaged the mental hands she had pushed her mother with. A moment later, Margaret was pounding on the door. Carrie held it shut, her lips trembling.
"There's going to be a judgment," Margaret White raved. "I wash my hands of it. I tried."
"Pilate said that," Carrie said. Her mother went away. A minute later, Carrie saw her go down the walk and cross the street on her way to work.
"Mama," she said softly, and put her forehead on the glass.
From The Shadow Exploded, page 129. Before turning to a more detailed analysis of prom night itself, it might be well to sum up what we know of Carrie White, the person.
We know that Carrie was the victim of her mother's religious mania. We know that she possessed a latent telekinetic talent, commonly referred to as TK. We know that this so-called wild talent is really a hereditary trait, produced by a gene that is usually recessive, if present at all. We suspect that the TK ability may be glandular in nature. We know that Carrie produced at least one demonstration of her ability as a small girl when she was put into an extreme situation of guilt and stress. We know that a second extreme situation of guilt and stress arose from a shower room hazing incident. It has been theorized, especially by William G. Throneberry and Julia Givens, Berkeley, that resurgence of the TK ability at this point was caused by both psychological factors, i.e., the reaction of the other girls and Carrie herself to their first menstrual period, and physiological factors, i.e., the advent of puberty. And finally, we know that on prom night, a third stress situation arose, causing the terrible events which we now must begin to discuss. We will begin with...
I'm not nervous, not a bit nervous.
Tommy had called earlier with her corsage, and now she was pinning it to the shoulder of her gown herself. There was no mama, of course, to do it for her and make sure it was in the right place. Mama had locked herself in the chapel and had been in there for the last 2 hours, praying hysterically. Her voice rose and fell in frightening, incoherent cycles.
I'm sorry, Mama, but I can't be sorry.
When she had it fixed to her satisfaction, she dropped her hands and stood quietly for a moment with her eyes closed. There was no full-length mirror in the house.
Vanity, vanity, all is vanity.
But she thought she was all right. She had to be. She opened her eyes again. The Black Forest cuckoo clock, bought with green stamps, said 7:10.
He'll be here in 20 minutes.
Would he? Maybe it was all just an elaborate joke. The final crusher. The ultimate punchline. To leave her sitting here half the night in her crushed velvet prom gown with its princess waistline, Juliet sleeves, and simple straight skirt, and her tea roses pinned to her left shoulder. From the other room, on the rise now. In hallowed earth, we know thou bring'st the eye that watcheth, the hideous three-lobed eye, and the sound of black trumpets. We most heartily repent.
Carrie did not think anyone could understand the brute courage it had taken to reconcile herself to this, to leave herself open to whatever fearsome possibilities the night might realize. Being stood up could hardly be the worst of them. In fact, in a kind of sneaking, wishful way, she thought it might be for the best if... No, stop that. Of course, it would be easier to stay here with Mama. Safer.
She knew what they thought of Mama. Well, maybe Mama was a fanatic. A freak. But at least she was predictable. The house was predictable. She never came home to laughing, shrieking girls who threw things. And if he didn't come, if she drew back and gave up, high school would be over in a month. Then what? A creeping, subterranean existence in this house, supported by Mama, watching game shows and soap operas all day on television at Mrs. Garrison's house when she had Carrie in to visit? Mrs. Garrison was 86. Walking down to the center to get a malted after supper at the Kelly Fruit when it was deserted, getting fatter, losing hope, losing even the power to think? No. Oh, dear God, please, no. Please let it be a happy ending.
Protect us from he with the split foot who waits in the alleys and in the parking lots of roadhouses, oh, Savior.
7:25. Restlessly, without thinking, she began to lift objects with her mind and put them back down, the way a nervous woman awaiting someone in a restaurant will fold and unfold a napkin.
She could dangle half a dozen objects in air at one time, and not a sign of tiredness or headache. She kept waiting for the power to abate, but it remained at high water with no sign of waning. The other night, on her way home from school, she had rolled a parked car. Oh, please, God, let it not be a joke. 20 feet down the main street curb with no strain at all. The courthouse idlers had stared at it as if their eyes were out, and of course she stared too, but she was smiling inside. The cuckoo popped out of the clock and spoke once. 7:30. She had grown a little wary of the terrific strain using the power seemed to put on her heart and lungs and internal thermostat. She suspected it would be all too possible for her heart to literally burst with the strain. It was like being in another's body and forcing her to run and run and run. You would not pay the cost yourself. The other body would. She was beginning to realize that her power was perhaps not so different from the powers of Indian fakirs who stroll across hot coals, run needles into their eyes, or blithely bury themselves for periods up to 6 weeks. Mind over matter in any form is a terrific drain on the body's resources. 7:32. He's not coming. Don't think about it. A watch pot doesn't boil. He'll come. No, he won't. He's out laughing at you with his friends, and after a little bit, they'll drive by in one of their fast, noisy cars, laughing and hooting and yelling. Miserably, she began lifting the sewing machine up and down, swinging it in widening arcs through the air. And protect us also from rebellious daughters imbued with the willfulness of the wicked one. Shut up! Carrie screamed suddenly. There was startled silence for a moment, and then the babbling chant began again. 7:33. Not coming. Then I'll wreck the house. The thought came to her naturally and cleanly. First the sewing machine, driven through the living room wall, the couch through a window, tables, chairs, books, and tracks all flying. The plumbing ripped loose and still spurting like arteries ripped free of flesh. The roof itself, if that were within her power, shingles exploding upward into the night like startled pigeons. Lights splashed gaudily across the window. Other cars had gone by, making her heart leap a little, but this one was going much more slowly. Oh! She ran to the window, unable to restrain herself, and it was him. Tommy, just climbing out of his car, and even under the streetlight he was handsome, and alive, and almost crackling. The odd word made her want to giggle. Mama had stopped praying. She grabbed her light silken wrap from where it had lain across the back of her chair and put it around her bare shoulders. She bit her lip, touched her hair, and would have sold her soul for a mirror. The buzzer in the hall made its harsh cry. She made herself wait, controlling the twitch in her hands, for the second buzz. Then she went slowly, with silken swish. She opened the door and he was there, nearly blinding in white dinner jacket and dark dress pants. They looked at each other, and neither said a word. She felt that her heart would break if he uttered so much as the wrong sound, and if he laughed, she would die. She felt, actually physically, her whole miserable life narrow to a point that might be an end or the beginning of a widening beam. Finally, helpless, she said, "Do you like me?" He said, "You're beautiful." She was. From The Shadow Exploded, page 131. While those going to the UN Spring Ball were gathering at the high school, or just leaving pre-prom buffets, Christine Hargensen and William Nolan had met in a room above a local town limits tavern called the Cavalier. We know that they had been meeting there for some time. That is, in the records of the White Commission. What we don't know is whether their plans were complete and irrevocable, or if they went ahead almost on whim. Is it time yet? She asked in the darkness. He looked at his watch. No. Faintly, through the board floor, came the thump of the jute playing She's Got to Be a Saint by Ray Price. The Cavalier, Chris reflected, hadn't changed their record since the first time she'd been here with a forged ID 2 years ago. Of course, then she'd been down in the tap rooms, not in one of Sam DeVos' specials. Billy's cigarette winked fitfully in the dark, like the eye of an uneasy demon. She watched it introspectively. She hadn't let him sleep with her until last Monday, when he had promised that he and his greaser friends would help her pull the string on Carrie White if she actually dared to go to the prom with Tommy Ross. But they had been here before and had had some pretty hot necking sessions, what she thought of as scotch love and what he would call, in his unfailing ability to pinpoint the vulgar, the dry humps. She had meant to make him wait until he had actually done something. But of course he did. He got the blood. But it had all begun to slip out of her hands, and it made her uneasy. If she had not given in willingly on Monday, he would have taken her by force. Billy had not been her first lover, but he was the first she could not dance and dandle at her whim. Before him, her boys had been clever marionettes with clear, pimple-free faces, and parents with connections and country club memberships. They drove their own VWs or Javelins or Dodge Chargers. They went to UMass or Boston College. They wore fraternity windbreakers in the fall and muscle shirts with bright stripes in the summer. They smoked marijuana a great deal and talked about the funny things that happened to them when they were wrecked. They began by treating her with patronizing good fellowship. All high school girls, no matter how good-looking, were bush league, and always ended up trotting after her with panting, dog-like lust. If they trotted long enough and spent enough in the process, she usually let them go to bed with her. Quite often she lay passively beneath them, not helping or hindering until it was over. Later, she achieved her own solitary climax while viewing the incident as a single closed loop of memory. She had met Billy Nolan following a drug bust at a Portland apartment. Four students, including Chris's date for the evening, had been busted for possession. Chris and the other girls were charged with being present there. Her father took care of it with quiet efficiency and asked her if she knew what would happen to her image in his practice if his daughter was taken up on a drug charge. She told him that she doubted if anything could hurt either one, and he took her car away. Billy offered her a ride home from school one afternoon a week later, and she accepted. He was what the other kids called a White Soxer or a machine shop chuck. Yet something about him excited her, and now, lying drowsily in this illicit bed, but with an awakening sense of excitement and pleasurable fear, she thought it might have been his car, at least at the start. It was a million miles from the machine-stamped, anonymous vehicles of her fraternity dates, with their ventless windows, fold-up steering wheels, and vaguely unpleasant smell of plastic seat covers and windshield solvent. Billy's car was old, dark, somehow sinister. The windshield was milky around the edges, as if a cataract was beginning to form. The seats were loose and unanchored. Beer bottles clicked and rolled in the back. Her fraternity dates drank Budweiser. Billy and his friends drank Rheingold. And she had to place her feet around a huge, grease-clotted Craftsman tool kit without a lid. The tools inside were of many different makes, and she suspected that many of them were stolen. The car smelled of oil and gas. The sound of straight pipes came loudly and exhilaratingly through the thin floorboards. A row of dials slung under the dash registered amps, oil pressure, and tack, whatever that was. The back wheels were jacked, and the hood seemed to point at the road. And of course he drove fast. On the third ride home, one of the bald front tires blew at 60 miles an hour. The car went into a screaming slide, and she shrieked aloud, suddenly positive of her own death. An image of her broken, bloody corpse thrown against the base of a telephone pole like a pile of rags flashed through her mind like a tabloid photograph. Billy cursed and whipped the fuzz-covered steering wheel from side to side. They came to a stop on the left-hand shoulder, and when she got out of the car on knees that threatened to buckle at every step, she saw that they had left a looping trail of scorched rubber for 70 feet. Billy was already opening the trunk, pulling out a jack, and muttering to himself. Not a hair was out of place. He passed her, a cigarette already dangling from the corner of his mouth. "Bring that toolkit, babe." She was flabbergasted. Her mouth opened and closed twice, like a beached fish, before she could get the words out.
I will not. You almost you crazy bastard. Besides, it's dirty.
He turned around and looked at her, his eyes flat. You bring it or I ain't taking you to the fucking fights tomorrow night.
I hate the fights.
She had never been, but her anger and outrage required absolutes. Her fraternity dates took her to rock concerts, which she hated. They always ended up next to someone who hadn't bathed in weeks. He shrugged, went back to the front end, and began jacking. She brought the toolkit, getting grease all over a brand new sweater. He grunted without turning around. His T-shirt had pulled out of his jeans, and the flesh of his back was smooth, tanned, alive with muscles. It fascinated her, and she felt her tongue creep into the corner of her mouth. She helped him pull the tire off the wheel, getting her hands black. The car rocked alarmingly on the jack, and the spare was down to the canvas in two places. When the job was finished and she got back in, there were heavy smears of grease across both the sweater and the expensive red skirt she was wearing. "If you think," she began as he got behind the wheel. He slid across the seat and kissed her, his hands moving heavily on her, from waist to breasts. His breath was redolent of tobacco. There was the smell of Brill cream and sweat. She broke it at last and stared down at herself, gasping for breath. The sweater was blotted with road grease and dirt now. 2750 in Jordan Marsh, and it was beyond anything but the garbage can. She was intensely, almost painfully excited. "How are you going to explain that?" he asked, and kissed her again. His mouth felt as if he might be grinning. "Feel me," she said in his ear. "Feel me all over. Get me dirty." He did. One nylon split like a gaping mouth. Her skirt, short to begin with, was pushed rudely up to her waist. He groped greedily, with no finesse at all. And something, perhaps that, perhaps the sudden brush with death, brought her to sudden, jolting orgasm. She had gone to the fights with him. 7:45, he said, and sat up in bed. He put on the lamp and began to dress. His body still fascinated her. She thought of last Monday night and how it had been. He had, no, time enough to think of that later, maybe, when it would do something for her besides cause useless arousal. She swung her own legs over the edge of the bed and slid into gossamer panties. "Maybe it's a bad idea," she said, not sure if she was testing him or herself. "Maybe we ought to just get back into bed and..." "It's a good idea," he said, and a shadow of humor crossed his face. "Pig blood for a pig." "What?" "Nothing. Come on, get dressed." She did, and when they left by the back stairs, she could feel a large excitement blooming, like a rapacious and night-flowering vine in her belly. From My Name is Susan Snell, page 45. You know, I'm not as sorry about all of it as people seem to think I should be. Not that they say it right out. They're the ones who always saw how dreadfully sorry they are. That's usually just before they ask for my autograph. But they expect you to be sorry. They expect you to get weepy, to wear a lot of black, to drink a little too much, or take drugs. They say things like,
Oh, it's such a shame, but you know what happened to her. And blah, blah, blah. But sorry.